Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
Greetings. It's 1 o'clock and time to jump here at WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, and this is Media Matters, coming to you live today, November 13th, 2011. Today we've got a show I've been waiting for a long time. Our guest is going to be Glenn Greenwald. And we're talking about Glenn's new book, With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. It should be a terrific hour. Hope you'll join us for it. But before we go to our guest, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
The ayes are 46, the nays are 52. The motion is not agreed to.
Internet activists cheered as the Senate sent a strong message to Internet service providers who want to prioritize content and services on the net. By a margin of 52 to 46, senators rejected a resolution of disapproval of the Federal Communication Commission's Open Internet Order and voted to uphold the commission's modest net neutrality rules. The vote leaves intact the FCC's ruling, which prevents Internet service providers from blocking or discriminating against Internet users. During a debate on Wednesday, several senators spoke out strongly for Internet freedom. Senator Al Franken of Minnesota said opponents of net neutrality are wrong to think that the FCC rules would be disastrous for business.
We expect that emails arrive at their destinations at the same speed, regardless of who is sending them. And we take for granted that the website for your local pizzeria loads as fast as the website for Domino's or Pizza Hut. And that is one of the reasons I care so very much about this issue. This isn't just about freedom of speech. It is also about protecting small businesses and entrepreneurs of all sizes.
Massachusetts Senator John Kerry said he and other net neutrality supporters are defending the rights of ordinary people.
The other side is coming here and trying to create a new structure where the process will be gamed once again in favor of the most powerful. I mean, this is really part of the whole debate that's going on in America today about the 99% who feel like everything is gamed against them and the system is geared by the people who have the money and the people who have the power who get what they want. That's what this debate is about.
Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington would have preferred even stronger net neutrality rules coming out of the FCC. She said wireless users remain unprotected and the fight for true internet freedom is far from over.
The FCC rules do not go far enough. You can't continue to have this half step and not clearly on the mobile side give consumers the protection they need. But for today, if you want to vote with internet consumers and internet users on driving down the cost of the internet, then vote against this resolution and keep the minimal FCC rules in place until we can get stronger legislation passed.
Who is going to save local news? Journalism education programs, according to a new report from the New America Foundation. As local news disappears, journalism students across the nation continue to churn out content on their campuses. The report suggests that journalism schools of all levels should branch out to support and contribute to the larger news ecosystem. Chris Anderson, an assistant professor of media culture at the College of Staten Island, co-authored the report. He says journalism programs are uniquely suited to help fill the information needs of communities.
there is a growing information deficit in local communities. And we need to stop treating journalism school work as simply educational and need to start treating it as actual reported content that is going to contribute to the knowledge in the community.
In fact, Anderson says journalism schools should base their programs on the hands-on teaching hospital model, where medical students work on real patients.
People come in with illnesses, with gunshot wounds, with injuries. They work with real people with real issues. And it's not seen as being strange or unusual or a lower level of medical service than you'll get anywhere else. We think that that mindset needs to translate into journalism schools. This is not an exercise. You are working with real journalistic issues, reporting on real journalistic news, and you need to both interface with other media outlets and conduct your reporting thinking about it in that way.
The report makes specific recommendations to journalism programs as they transition into the digital age, including teaming up with traditional local journalism outlets. The result, Anderson hopes, will be a new legion of journalism students responding to the local needs of communities while they're at school, not just after they graduate.
That will then boost the amount of journalism being produced. It will boost the amount of information that people have to make political decisions about what matters in the world. And that in and of itself is a very necessary thing right now. We are losing information. It is not yet being replaced. We need to look around and find the institutions already there that can help us replace it.
To read the report, Shaping 21st Century Journalism, visit newamerica.net.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, November 13th, 2011, here on WILL AM 580. Our guest today is someone who has been a frequent guest on the program, one of the truly outstanding journalists of our times. And I would say he's rapidly moving towards the status where he will not need much of an introduction to anyone, like a handful of other guests we periodically have in the show. About Glenn Greenwald, Michael Moore said, "The first thing I do when I turn on the computer in the morning is go to Glenn Greenwald's blog to see what he said. He's truly one of our greatest writers right now." I agree completely. Glenn Greenwald has just written the brand new book, has just been published, With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful, out by Metropolitan Books. And Glenn is here to join us on the phone. Glenn, welcome to Media Matters.
Great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Well, it was a real pleasure to read your book. It's one of the joys of doing this show, is I have an opportunity to read books like this right when they come off the press. And it's a very important book, of singular importance, I'd even say. And, you know, for listeners who've heard the term rule of law, and I think we've all heard the term, we have a general understanding of it, why don't you explain what exactly the rule of law is, why it's important, and where it sort of fits into the American political and constitutional history?
It is funny because it's a phrase that is bandied about a lot, and yet I think it's very rarely defined, and a lot of people who use the term don't think very much about what it means. But it's actually a fairly simple term. It really designates nothing more than the fact that we're all equally bound to a common set of rules, regardless of power, prestige, or position. But that's what a society that lives under the rule of law is really intended to require above all else. And you can pretty much find that definition in the writings of contemporary legal scholars, or if you go back a little earlier in a couple decades to when the U.S. used to lecture the Third World about what they had to do to be countries that lived under the rule of law, that nobody is above the law, that nobody is below the law. And you really find it most centrally in the writings of the founders, who disagreed about a lot of things, but all agreed that in order to have any kind of a just society, you could have lots of different forms of inequality, wealth inequality and income inequality and inequality and power and position. All those things would be inevitable and even desirable, but that the only way that that would be legitimate to have those kind of outcome inequalities is if we all play by the same common set of rules, that we were all equal before the law, that justice is blind, all these kind of cliches that we've learned. And it was really central to the American design. Of course, the founders violated that principle in all sorts of ways, but they continuously emphasized its supremacy, and it became sort of the guiding aspirational principle of American political life.
In fact, in the opening of the book and at the end, both, I mean, you invoke passages, sometimes longer ones, oftentimes quotes, from Jefferson, Madison, Washington, over to John Adams and Alexander Hamilton, all basically making that point that this is the one non-negotiable aspect of what distinguishes America from other nations. And as I read that, it was so striking, Glenn. I thought today that actually that's still true today. I think people who are on the, you know, the libertarians on the right, people, socialists on the left, all basically adhere to the rule of law as a guiding principle. But while we have a rhetorical claim to it, your book tells us that's not really what's going on.
Well, that's what's so interesting is I think there are certain values that are kind of embedded in the American political fabric, the ones with which are inculcated from the time that we're children about what defines America and what makes it free and all of that. And I think the idea that we, because the country was born of this sort of anti-monarchical sentiment, the idea that we don't have any kings, we don't have any princes, that everybody is equal before the law is one of those kind of defining principles that we learn through osmosis. And one of the things that I wanted to do was to sort of trace the origins of this idea that if you're sufficiently powerful and important that you can and should be exempt from the rule of law, this kind of explicit repudiation of the rule of law, not just violating it in our actions, but actually arguing that it shouldn't apply. And the first time you really see this argument being made is during the pardon of Richard Nixon by Gerald Ford. And what was so interesting about that pardon, in my view, was that you had most media stars and political elites who were arguing in favor of this pardon, and yet the vast majority of the American citizenry was really kind of outraged and offended by the idea that when the world's most or the country's most powerful political figure got caught committing felonies, he wasn't treated like ordinary Americans who get caught committing crimes, namely indicted and prosecuted and then imprisoned. He would be shielded completely from the consequences of his acts. And I think the reason why the citizenry reacted that way, and you still see this now and then in polls and the like about whether people should be prosecuted or at least investigated when they get caught committing crimes, the reason for that is because we're all kind of taught, it's drummed into our head, this idea that nobody is above the law and that when even the most powerful among us get caught committing crimes, they too have to go before courts and prove their innocence or contest their guilt, and this is the principle that we've begun to really explicitly repudiate for the first time over the last several years, and it's what has led to us witnessing the most egregious crimes committed by the most powerful people go completely unpunished.
Our guest today is Glenn Greenwald here on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Glenn Greenwald is with us live. We're talking about his brand new book, which is just published by Metropolitan Books, with Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. Our phone lines are open at WILL. The number here, 217-333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Glenn Greenwald, I think I've probably somewhat skeptical or cynical after seeing living through the last four decades of American history. One of the things that was striking to me in the book was that it is a relatively recent phenomenon. And one of the illuminating discussions in your book was about a very famous political scandal in the 1920s, the Teapot Dome scandal. And I'd like you to talk about that to say that, you know, there was another tradition in America prior to the 1970s.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I touch on just a few examples in the book to give kind of a flavor of for the fact that it really did used to be the case that even the most powerful among us were really vulnerable to legal consequences if wrongdoing were exposed. I mean, to me, the most kind of vivid example is when Teddy Roosevelt was first inaugurated, he immediately targeted the two most powerful corporations then in the United States, Standard Oil and J.P. Morgan, to break them up into tiny little pieces on monopolistic grounds. And of course, Franklin Roosevelt, you know, declared that the hatred of Wall Street was something that he wore as a badge of honor, that he welcomed it, things that are inconceivable. Today, you have Boss Tweed, who was at the time, you know, not only the most politically powerful figure, but a multi-millionaire, extremely rich from political corruption, who was brought down by a combination of an aggressive prosecutor and the media, something also inconceivable today. And this Teapot Dome scandal was so amazing just because the political class could easily have allowed it to go unpunished because it really wasn't discovered until almost a decade later. The true evidence of it was really discovered much, much after the crimes had been committed, and yet they insisted upon going back into the past because these were high-level cabinet officials who had been engaged in criminal misconduct and investigating and ultimately prosecuting them and kind of retroactively changing the way that lots of political elites were perceived, sort of the exact opposite of the idea that we have now, that it's best not to dig into the past and instead to look to the future. So as I said, I mean, you can find obviously lots of instances where the idea of equality before the law was violently betrayed in American history. I mean, the country was founded as one big, glaring, oozing example of a violation of that principle. But the fact that we explicitly embrace this idea that we're all equal before the law is really what was responsible for so many instances of American progress over the next two centuries. And that's why I think this idea that we now argue against it, that you frequently hear media figures and political figures arguing literally that if you're too powerful, if the country depends upon you too much, then it's in our common good to allow those crimes to go unpunished. That's what happened with the Iran-Contra criminals, with the creation of the worldwide torture regime, spying on Americans without warrants, the attack on Iraq, and now even the sort of systemic fraud in the financial industry that precipitated the 2008 financial crisis. You hear arguments being made all the time. They've become normalized, that if you're of sufficient status and instrumental enough in the society, then it's in everyone's good that we just go ahead and let bygones be bygones. And that's created this sort of law-breaking license among our most powerful.
And you make clear in the book, Glenn Greenwald, this is not a one party is guilty and the other party is less guilty. This is a fully shared, complicitous arrangement between the two political parties. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the amazing things is that when Barack Obama was running for president, he was asked on several occasions whether he believed that investigations into the crimes of the Bush era were necessary. And what he said in every instance was that, of course, because nobody is above the law. And if crimes were committed, then punishments are necessary, the same way ordinary Americans who rob banks or embezzle or sell drugs on the street corner are punished. And yet, before he was even inaugurated, he began aggressively signaling to, in as many places as he could, that he now opposed investigations of any kind into Bush-era crimes. And there was an amazing article in the New York Times in December of 2008 talking about how he had made his opposition to investigations so clear. And what it described was this sort of gentleman's agreement that existed between administrations, where a president who had been inaugurated would know that by protecting the crimes of his predecessors, he would in essence be free to commit crimes in office with impunity and not be prosecuted as well, because it continues this sort of ongoing agreement amongst the two parties that they will not prosecute each other for the crimes committed while in office. And each president has an incentive to maintain that law-breaking license, as do elites generally. And that's why you see presidents from both parties always protecting the crimes of their predecessors, and why you see media figures and political figures arguing in favor of it as well. It's really a class-based prerogative that we've created, where the most powerful people have the shield of immunity and nobody else does.
A key theme in the book, Glenn Greenwald, is the role of the news media, especially the elite media that sort of sets the agenda for debate of major political issues, like whether to let lawbreakers not be prosecuted because they're so powerful and so important. And I think it's fair to say, and I think anyone who's read your work and Salon.com is familiar with this, that you pretty much systematically demolish the news media and expose them for an extraordinary amount of support for these practices.
Well, what's amazing to me is if you look at how journalists perceived themselves and were perceived, you know, 5 or 6 decades ago. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, there was a lot of overlap and a lot of incestuous relationship between some journalists and government officials even back then. You don't want to romanticize the past, but it really is true that you sort of had this iconic idea of what a journalist is, that it was somebody who was basically going to be fairly poor and working class in their lives. They weren't going to make very much money. They were kind of slovenly dressed. They kind of were besieged with ink-stained hands and in a sort of slovenly newsroom late at night, pounding out articles on their typewriter and their sort of old typewriter. And the idea was that these were really people who were situated outside of the power structure. They were not elites at all. They were very much, you know, in terms of how they lived their lives, where they came from, how much money they made, and most importantly of all, just kind of their personality, their mentality. These are people who were on purpose situated as adversarial to those in power and who wanted to serve as watchdogs over it or subvert them, or who were just generally anti-authoritarian. And that has completely and radically changed. So, you know, now virtually every known media figure is a very high-ranking and highly paid employee of one of the nation's largest media conglomerates or corporate conglomerates. They make tons of money. They are not in any way situated on the outside of the power structure or power circles. They're very much integrated into it. They perceive these political figures as their colleagues and their friends and their neighbors. They're socioeconomically on the same level as them. And so the role of the journalist has really transformed radically from kind of watchdog over power to spokesman for power and servant to it. And so it's really not surprising that whenever there are proposed investigations into crimes committed by the political class, the leading proponents of shielding them from accountability are journalists. I mean, you see this in every instance. And it's amazing. If you go back to the beginning of the Obama presidency, if you look at polls, a lot of people really don't know this, but if you look at polls, there's lots of polls. I mean, four or five different ones from leading polling organizations that asked Americans, do you favor investigations to determine if torture, spying, and obstruction of justice by the Bush administration were illegal? Large majorities wanted investigations, and large pluralities wanted criminal investigations. And yet, almost unanimously, every media figure went on television and into their columns and urged Obama not to investigate or prosecute these crimes on the grounds that it would be better for the country if he just let it go. And that's because this split comes from the fact that most Americans believe that elites should be held accountable under the law, but journalists identify with the political class, with the political elites. Their self-esteem, their importance, everything they value is grounded in protection of the political system, and they therefore take the leading role, not in advocating for investigations as a watchdog would, but in demanding that there be no investigations the way a spokesperson would. And that's clearly the role that they've undertaken.
In fact, Glenn Greenwald, I'm willing to bet if one goes back and looks at the record, probably the only voice among journalists who had any airtime at all on sort of the talking head shows would have been yours might have opposed this. I can't think of a single other one who made an issue out of this and drew a line in the sand.
When I say literally unanimous, I mean, I really mean that. It was almost impossible to find examples of journalists with any significant venue arguing in favor of it. I did go on lots of shows at the time and argue in favor of it, and I was almost alone. And I mean, even if there were, you know, sort of liberal media figures who weren't necessarily opposed to investigations, they were very much kind of acquiescing to the idea, especially once it was clear that Obama was not going to pursue them, that these were things that we could just do without. And, you know, the idea that what's amazing is the very idea that our political leaders should be prosecuted when they get caught committing crimes. So, for example, we really did have a criminal statute in place that said that if you spy on Americans without the warrants from the FISA court, that is a felony punishable by up to 5 years in prison and a $10,000 fine for each offense. I mean, we just had a law in place that said that. The Bush administration got caught doing exactly that, which the criminal law prohibited. And the argument that I was making at the time was that, well, if a president gets caught violating the law that the criminal law says you can't do without being a felon, then the rule of law requires that we treat him like everybody else, which is to investigate and prosecute and put him in prison for it. That idea has become radical and fringe, so much so to the point where I was almost the only one arguing it in these circles. And what instead has become the prevailing norm, the mainstream view, is that political elites who get caught committing crimes in office should be shielded from the consequences of their crime. We've completely reversed the idea of the rule of law to the point we've abandoned it completely. And if you argue in favor of the rule of law, once the cornerstone of American political life, you now are sort of engaged in almost a self-marginalizing act. It's almost as though you believe in some exotic or strange position.
Our guest today on Media Matters, who you've just been listening to, is Glenn Greenwald, author of the brand new book, With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful, just published by Metropolitan Books, literally just off the press. The phone lines are open here at Media Matters, 217-333-9255. 1-800-222-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We've barely skimmed the surface of what's in this very rich and important book. And Glenn, one of the key points you make in the book, and spend a lot of time, a couple of chapters developing, is that the exemption from the law, being above the law, not really fearing prosecution for crimes, has extended from the political elite to our corporate elite, that the wealthiest, most powerful corporate figures in America now have also got this sort of 007 treatment by the rule of law.
That's right. I think that's such a critical development because, as I said, I mean, you can trace the genesis of this rhetorical framework to the Ford pardon of Nixon. And it then got applied to lots of political figures. It was applied next in Iran-Contra and then throughout the political scandals of the next couple decades where none of the high-ranking political officials who engaged in illegal acts were punished legally or criminally. But what was amazing is when the Bush administration, when it was clear that they were going to successfully shield themselves from all accountability for their eavesdropping crimes that the New York Times had exposed and won a Pulitzer Prize for exposing, they then announced that they wanted immunity not only for themselves, but also for the telecom industry, for AT&T and Sprint and Verizon, that had helped them spy on Americans without warrants by turning over records en masse to the government about their customers' communication activities and even allowing direct access to their networks so that spying could be done without warrants. And what was so amazing about that was that there were laws written after the Church Committee in the mid-1970s that were written specifically to say to the telecom industry, you are not permitted to enable government spying on your customers unless you are presented with warrants from the court. And if you do that, you will be guilty of a crime and you can be sued by your customers. And when the telecom industry got exposed for having broken those laws as directly as can be, they began being sued by their customers. They began losing in court. And yet the Bush administration demanded, and Congress, under the control of the Democrats, ultimately gave them full-scale retroactive immunity, which said that their customers are barred from suing the telecoms for having violated their privacy that way, that the telecoms are shielded from any and all consequences, criminal or civil, for the acts of illegality that they had gotten caught engaged in. And the arguments that had been made on behalf of political elites were then extended to these private sector corporations, that we need these telecoms for our national security, that it's too disruptive to make them pay damages for the violations of their customers' privacy. And it sort of got extended on behalf of private sector elites. So now if you were not only a political elite but also a financially powerful corporation or individual, then you too could invoke this rationale for legal immunity even when you got caught brazenly breaking the law. And we've now seen that extended to the Wall Street crimes, much worse crimes, that led to the financial crisis as well. And not a single banking executive or Wall Street firm has been investigated, let alone prosecuted for those crimes either, based on the same exact line of reasoning.
Our guest, Glenn Greenwald. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The phone lines are open at 217-333-9455 or it's toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Glenn Greenwald writes for Salon.com, one of the outstanding and award-winning journalists of our times and the author of the brand-new book, With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and to Protect the Powerful, out by Metropolitan Books. Let's go to the phone lines right now for our first caller. Line 4, Peoria, you're on the air with Glenn Greenwald.
Hello. During the Bush administration, or the 8 years of the crimes, I believe, were so horrific. And then when it was over, and I believe that like Cheney and Rumsfeld had so much experience with being immune to any kind of criminal prosecution that they knew that nothing would happen to them. They could do anything they wanted to. And I wonder, was there any chance, I thought the only chance for accountability would be a Truth and Reconciliation Committee or like they had in South Africa, because I thought these crimes were so unusual. Was there any feeling that that could have happened? I know it's too late now, but it's just, do you think that that ever could have happened?
Well, thank you, caller. And Glenn, before you answer, let me say, because I know you're too modest to say this, Glenn, that in the book, With Liberty and Justice for Some, has an extensive and illuminating discussion of exactly this issue of the Obama administration's relationship to the Bush crimes.
Right. Well, you know, as far as the caller's first point, and they were both very good points, you know, it is true that one of the reasons why the Bush officials were so willing to engage in such extremely lawless and radical conduct is because they did know that they could do so without consequences, and they knew that because we've become a country that does not punish our political officials, our most powerful political officials, when they get caught breaking the law. I mean, Dick Cheney was Gerald Ford's chief of staff, and he was there for the pardon of Nixon. So all of our political elites know that they can break the law and more or less be unpunished. And as Alexander Hamilton and lots of other theorists have pointed out, if you remove the sanction, the punishment for criminal misconduct, you're essentially guaranteeing that people will commit crimes, because if there's no punishment from it, then they have no incentive to refrain from doing it. And that's exactly what we've done in terms of our political and financial elite, is we've told them, if you commit crimes, you will get away with it. And as far as any chance to investigate in terms of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission or the like, I mean, one of the amazing things about what the Obama administration did is it wasn't just that they failed to prosecute criminally using the Justice Department. They blocked every other form of investigation as well. So there were members of Congress, members of the Democratic Party, that actually did want to convene that kind of a commission to at least make a comprehensive finding about what was done. And the Obama administration made clear that they didn't want a congressional investigation even of these crimes. And since they controlled the Democrats in Congress, that didn't happen. And even more amazingly, there were other countries like Germany and Spain whose citizens had been subject to some of the torture crimes and detention crimes of the Bush years, who wanted to prosecute, all these countries belong to a treaty called the Convention Against Torture that obligates every country to prosecute torturers wherever they are found. And so Germany and Spain, citing these treaty obligations and the fact that it was their citizens who were tortured, commenced investigations, started to consider the possibility of investigating Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and others. And as WikiLeaks cables revealed, the Obama administration, early on in his presidency, intervened very aggressively and marshaled diplomatic forces and all kinds of pressure to stop these investigations in other countries, intervened in their judicial process to prevent these investigations from proceeding. So it wasn't just that they didn't want to prosecute. That was bad enough. It was that they wanted no form of accountability, no form of investigation of any kind, and they were successful in putting a stop to all of it.
Let's go to our next caller now. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with Glenn Greenwald.
Hi. Obstruction of justice at a high level. It's such a fluid category anyway, so they could be charged, I guess, of that. I wanted to ask about, there have been some international tribunals, various places around the world, that have just done this ex officio, but I think that now with the focus of the Occupy movement and some of the other tribunals that are getting a little attention, I guess, that maybe there should be one here on, you know, in the D.C. Area. But I wanted you to address that. I know you've spoken to the Oakland Occupied, and we're excited about it. But I also wanted to plumb this a little bit, and I hope it's not too much of a digression, which is that a while back there was a attributed sort of idea that there was a coup brewing if the Obama administration went after these folks. Now, this sounds like CYA in some way, because there's no basis for it. But in history, actually, as recently as the FDR times, there was a plutocrat coup brewing, and it's not much talked about, but they went to the wrong general, apparently, Smedley Butler, who became a critic of what he had done so long ago. I guess I'm kind of motivated because this is Veterans Day weekend and all. He's the guy that wrote I Was a Gangster for Capitalism and Collector for Brown Brothers Banks and stuff. So they actually went to him to see if he would help engineer this. So there is a history of this kind of machination going on, but I don't take it seriously. But then the U.S. looks more and more like a excuse the expression, banana republic than ever. So I just wonder whether you'd heard about that or whether what you think. Appreciate your efforts.
Thank you. Thank you very much, caller. Glenn, let me just add on to that if I can. I mean, when you look at the ferocity and the universal support for keeping political and now leading billionaire and corporate officials above the law, not having their lawbreaking being challenged, it does one make you wonder if someone came into office and actually started enforcing the rule of law, and you have the media covering it the way they do, that would really, it would be, you know, it'd be quite extraordinary, wouldn't it?
It would, and I mean, the caller is referring to this report that someone had claimed that early on when the Obama administration was talking about the possibility of investigating Bush crimes, that they were concerned that if they did, there would be a coup. And as I think the caller suggested, and I certainly think so too, this is sort of just, you know, retroactive justification. I mean, of course it's the case that if one administration prosecutes the prior administration for crimes, it would be incredibly politically disruptive. There'd be lots of disagreement and divisiveness and the like. But that's not an excuse for failing to apply the rule of law. I do think the more interesting question is the one that both you and the caller just raised, which is this idea that, well, if there's a politician who is subverting the prevailing order too extremely, that there could actually be some kind of a coup. And one of the amazing aspects, I think, about our political culture is that it used to be the case, not all that long ago, probably 5 years ago even, maybe 10 years ago, that if you stood up and talked about the United States as a place where there could be a coup or that there would be an oligarchical assertion of power that would override democratic institutions, or you talked about the United States as a banana republic, that this is sort of the language of radicalism and extremism, and it was only something that people who were kind of in these marginalized places of dissent would say. And yet now the United States has changed and become so degraded that you can pick up even the most establishment sources and read these kinds of discussions. So you could even, I mean, you could pick up the New York Times and you can see Nicholas Kristof, this sort of the most establishment liberal columnist, frequently describing the United States as a banana republic and a third world country because of the disappearance of the middle class and the way in which financial elites basically run rampant over our democratic institutions. And there's an article that, you know, I think is one of the most extraordinary articles I've read over the past few years, which I highly recommend for everyone. It was in the May 2009 issue of The Atlantic, and it was written by Simon Johnson, who was a former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, as establishment a position as it gets. And the title of the article was The Quiet Coup. And this word coup refers to what he claims is an oligarchical coup, a revolution on the part of the nation's plutocrats, that they have co-opted the nation's, you know, legal and political institutions to such a degree that it really does resemble the most corrupt kleptocracies in third world countries that he worked on as part of the IMF. And so the kinds of power that you can see people who are the most financially empowered now exert, really, it really does make our legal and political institutions almost illegitimate and inoperable. And to get to the caller's first point, I think, you know, that's why you do see this kind of protest movement growing, first the Tea Party and now the Occupy movement taking to the streets and being the sustained, angry sort of dissent, not to any one politician or political party, but to the system itself, because of this perception that our political and legal institutions are now illegitimate. And I think that's a major reason why.
Glenn, while we're on that subject of the Occupy movement starting in Wall Street, now extending all across the nation, including Champaign-Urbana, what is your take on it, and what do you think role it can have in our politics?
Well, I think it's one of the most exciting and inspiring developments politically in at least several years. I actually have been touring the country the last few weeks in connection with my book and have visited a lot of sites. And so I feel like I have a much better insight into what's driving it. And one of the interesting things is that I think at first there was this attempt to sort of depict it as this kind of trite, obsolete relic of the past, that it was basically just a bunch of communists and socialists,
people
who didn't have much, the hippie movement, people who didn't have much demanding that people who had a lot give some to them, this kind of just like general anger over inequality. And I think what's pretty clear is that, you know, there's been lots of inequality in the United States for several decades now, growing inequality. And mere inequality unto itself could not sustain a big protest movement in the United States. We've sort of been inculcated with the idea that inequality is a good thing, that we accept it as long as it's well-deserved. I mean, Steve Jobs can die with $8 billion, and very few people begrudge it because there's a perception, right or wrong, that he actually deserved it. I think what's really driving the anger is the perception that this inequality has become illegitimate. And the reason it's become illegitimate is because of the perception, which I think is clearly true, that the people who are winning and who have been able to accumulate all of these material goods at the expense of everybody else have not won because they've deserved it, because it's the byproduct of meritocracy, but because they've cheated, that these are ill-gotten gains, that they are illegitimate outcomes. And the reason they're illegitimate is because they no longer play by the same rules as everybody else. They've been able to exempt themselves from the rule of law, from the same set of constraints to which the rest of us are bound, and that the anger is really over the fact that this outcome inequality is no longer fair or just, but has become illegitimate because our institutions are illegitimate and they control them. And I think that's really what's driving this movement as much as anything else.
It's really hard to read your book, Glenn Greenwald, with Liberty and Justice or Some, and get your game face fired up to go out and dive into the Obama campaign. To be honest, or to be blunt, the Obama administration comes across as, you know, very poorly in this book, and certainly not as especially principled. And, you know, is that an accurate, do you think I'm being fair in my description, and or am I being unfair? I'd like your take on that. But if that is fair, then, you know, what does that mean for how we do politics in this country?
Well, you know, one of the things that happened, and I think this is a big part of the Occupy movement as well, is that the Obama campaign in 2008 specifically and deliberately targeted the group of people who had decided that there was no point in being involved in politics, that they were just, as Obama described it, kind of they had given into this corrosive cynicism. They believed that no matter who they voted for, no matter what they did, that the political class just simply didn't listen to them. And all of this stuff about yes, we can, and the audacity of hope and all of that was designed to persuade those people that specifically that there was a reason for them to get involved in the political process, to donate money, to donate their time and energy and resources, and put hope in the Obama campaign, because as sort of daunting as all these forces are that we've been discussing, the Obama presidency could actually change in a fundamental way how the political process works, that it was going to have this sort of people's army behind it, and they would be able to circumvent the standard factions that run Washington and change on whose behalf it functions. And I think, you know, most people who believe that have seen just what a scam that turned out to be. They watch Wall Street thrive and the middle class disappear, and the Obama presidency devoted to those who are richest and most powerful, and everything continue in the same way. And I think huge numbers of those people, ironically, became even more cynical because they realized, well, if it didn't work in this case, then it's never going to work. And they realized that placing hope in the political process was really futile, and that going out into the streets and protesting and citizen unrest and disruption was really the far more viable option for effectuating meaningful change. And so, you know, at the end of the day, I guess everybody has to decide whether the small differences between the two parties is enough to warrant your caring about the outcome, or whether or not your energies are better spent trying to change the political culture from outside of the electoral and partisan system. And I think one of the things you see from this protest movement is a lot of people are opting for the latter.
Our guest, Glenn Greenwald. We have a caller on line two who's been waiting very patiently. Let's go to that caller down line two. Urbana, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just have a couple points. First, getting back to when you were talking about that, you know, the politicians are above the law, I just was hoping to get your comments on the fact that, well, Congress didn't feel like it wasn't important enough to try to impeach Clinton on the whole Monica Lewinsky scandal, so that seemed like they felt that was important enough to pursue. So I was hoping you can comment about that. My second point was when you started talking about the Occupy movement. I think as time has gone on, maybe the media has kind of portrayed that, has done a little bit better job of doing reporting on that. But it seemed like with the Tea Party movement, as soon as they started protesting, the media really went after that. Oh, yeah, these are, you know, passionate protesters who are against taxes, and that was good enough. But it seems like with the Occupy Wall Street movement and left movements in general, it's like it seems that we have to practically write a research paper on exactly what our points are and what we stand for. Otherwise, we're just irrelevant, or we don't know what we're talking about. At least that's my perception. So I was just hoping you could comment on those two things. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Glenn Greenwald?
Sure. Well, the interaction between the media and the Occupy movement has been incredibly interesting to me, because what you saw first from the media was this kind of bafflement that people would even be angry about anything at all. Like, you know, sort of this sense like things are going really well in the United States. Why would people be out in the streets so angry? And of course, that's because things are going really well for those media figures who are commenting, and they don't interact with mass joblessness and homelessness and foreclosures and the like. And then the idea became, well, what message are they trying to send? What is it that they're specifically, what is it they want? And of course, that was unbelievably stupid as well, since there were all kinds of ways to know exactly what people were angry about, beginning with the name, which was Occupy Wall Street, which sort of gave a pretty good clue about what it was that this message was intended to convey. But I think, you know, ultimately, this idea that, well, the movement needed to submit a specific list of legislative proposals that it wanted, you know, in kind of pretty PowerPoint presentations, was really a way for the media and the political system and the culture itself to demand that the movement sort of translate itself into the language that the media uses, so that the media could then start pigeonholing it, putting it placing it on the ideological spectrum, and then figuring out how to kind of control it and then dismiss it. And it was specifically the refusal to do that, to start submitting legislative demands, that has been the real genius of this movement, because it kept it open, so that it was just kind of a protest movement of anger that was open to citizens from across the ideological perspective, or people who don't identify with one of the ideologies or the other, who felt welcome there, and that's the reason that it grew. But the bigger and more important point is that this movement was intended to be just kind of a generalized dissent from the prevailing norms. It was a way of saying, we are just tired of being sort of put into the system that turns us into commodities, that is fundamentally unfair, that is unresponsive to our needs and interests, and just sort of wants to squeeze and exploit us. We want to create our own space outside of it where everything is different. And it took a long time for the media, and I think to some extent it's still taking them some time, to understand just how fundamental this dissent was. And I think that the failure the refusal to comport with the media demands and turn itself into something more specific has been a big cause of its success, and I hope that continues.
Our guest, Glenn Greenwald. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, and WILL AM 580. Glenn Greenwald writes for Salon.com and is also the author of the brand new book, With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. We've got a caller who's been waiting patiently. Let's go now to line one, Champagne. You're on the air.
Oh, hello. I'm wondering whether you, in this book, you look not only at sort of immunity from legal consequences at the top of the power spectrum, but kind of super sensitivity at the bottom. You know, we have, you know, almost 1% of our population in prison, and something like a 15th of the black adult population in prison. And you know, locally, we see a steady stream of cases that are, you know, show up as resisting a peace officer, which look as though they ought to be more like police brutality cases. You know, this seems like it's an important part of the myth of the rule of law, and I'm just wondering how you feel it fits in, and also whether you think that this is something that you see reflected in the Occupy movement as far as general protest. So I'll stop with that.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Glenn Greenwald, let me just say, for listeners who might not know this, you have your penultimate chapter as a major chapter on precisely this issue.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so glad the caller raised this point, because for me, this is really the key point, is that, you know, it would be one thing if this great leniency that we've been talking about that is applied to elites were applied across the board. Then you could have, you know, a reasonable debate about whether leniency was a good approach to criminal justice, but at least the rule of law would be preserved because everybody would be treated equally. But that's exactly what isn't the case. For ordinary Americans, we've created the exact opposite world, where, as the caller suggested, we have created the world's harshest and most merciless penal system for everybody else who isn't powerful. We imprison more of our citizens than any other country in the world by far, including countries with much larger populations like China and India. I think the most amazing statistic in that regard is that the U.S. has roughly 5% of the world's population. 5% of the world's population are Americans, and yet 25% of the world's prison population is on American soil. I mean, we imprison more of our citizens for longer periods of time for more trivial infractions, and with less opportunity for mercy and forgiveness and leniency than any Western country in the world, and then almost any country in the world by far. And that is the most incredible part of this. That's the most, you know, sort of fundamental evisceration of the rule of law, is that the very same elite class that has vested itself with almost full-scale immunity when it gets caught committing crimes has imposed one of the world's harshest punishment schemes on anyone who isn't powerful, on essentially ordinary Americans. And the sort of personification of that is that, you know, Richard Nixon kind of built his political career in the 1960s as the law and order candidate. He ran against the disorder of the 1960s. He condemned Martin Luther King for civil disobedience and saying it was teaching the nation's youth that they could break the law whenever they wanted. He started the drug war. He demanded that criminals be punished mercilessly, that we not think about root causes, and that we instead just put them in prison for long periods of time. And yet the minute that he got caught breaking the law, he arranged for himself to get full-scale immunity. He never saw the inside of a courtroom, let alone the inside of a prison. And so this is really the true violation of the rule of law, is that exactly to the extent that we immunize and forgive the crimes of our elites, we punish more harshly than ever, and with more with less forgiveness than any other country. It's a very racially disparate impact, this punishment scheme. That's how we treat ordinary citizens. So it's a completely opposite world that you receive before the bar of justice based on who you are, and that's exactly the opposite of what the rule of law was intended to guarantee.
Yeah, Glenn Greenwald, in the book you talk at some length about the WikiLeaks scandal. You've also blogged about this at Salon.com. I think you've been probably the leading reporter to really go after this issue, how it's being covered in the news media, and how does it fit into your general argument?
Well, you know, it fits in a couple ways. I mean, we were talking before about the NSA eavesdropping scandal and how nobody was punished for the crimes that were committed as part of the illegal eavesdropping program, although there was one person who did end up paying a price in that scandal, and only one person, and his name was Thomas Tam, who was the mid-level Justice Department lawyer who in 2004 discovered that the Bush officials were eavesdropping on Americans without the warrants required by law and picked up the phone and called Eric Lichtblau at the New York Times and blew the whistle on that program. And he, unlike the people who actually committed the crimes, had a grand jury convened against him. He lost his job. He had subpoenas issued against him. He had to hire a lawyer even though he couldn't afford it, so he ended up in bankruptcy. He was very psychologically injured as a result of this persecution. And it really illustrates that how the law is sort of used as this coercive tool on the part of the powerful so that they protect themselves from the crimes they commit, and yet they punish those who expose their crimes and wrongdoing. And you very much see the same thing with WikiLeaks. I mean, WikiLeaks has exposed countless instances of very serious improprieties, illegalities, and corruption on the part of the world's most powerful political and financial elites. Almost none of that has led to any accountability, and yet the government and the media sort of jointly have combined to conspire to destroy WikiLeaks, to render it inoperable, to cut off its funding, to think about ways to criminalize and prosecute it. And so here you see the law being used to punish anybody who would challenge those in power and shield those in power even when they get caught committing crimes, and WikiLeaks is sort of the ultimate embodiment of that.
One of the things, Glenn Greenwald, you do in the book, have been a practicing attorney and a civil rights attorney, constitutional lawyer. And, you know, you talk about, and I think a lot of Americans aren't familiar with this, you know, the Nuremberg trial and the importance of it, and also the role of treaties to our Constitution and their singular importance. And so how what's going on is really an abrogation of the most fundamental sense of our legal tradition. Could you just talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, this notion of, you know, kind of multi-tiered justice systems based on who you are was really pioneered in the foreign relations context. I mean, the United States has long been applying legal standards to less powerful nations from which it has exempted itself. And to me, you know, one of the most vivid examples of that is what was done after after World War II as part of the Nuremberg trials, when we, you know, didn't take Nazi defendants and shoot them in the head and then dump their corpse into the ocean. Instead, we put them on trial. And what we said at the time was that the reason it's so imperative to put them on trial and show the world what it is that they did wrong is because we wanted to establish standards of justice, principles of justice, that would govern Western society into the future. And what was said at the Nuremberg trials by Robert Jackson, the lead prosecutor, who was the former attorney general under President Truman, was that the kingpin crime that was committed by the Germans, the defendants who were on trial, was not genocide or gas chambers or ethnically cleansing large regions of Europe. It was, the kingpin crime was aggressive war. That was what sort of enabled all the other crimes. And what Jackson said in the opening statement and in the closing statement was that this tribunal would have validity only if the principles promulgated applied not only to the Nazi defendants, but also to all nations here assembled, meaning the United States and its allies. And, of course, the United States has engaged in aggressive war on countless occasions since then, the most egregious example of which was the war in Iraq, where we attacked another country, killed at least 100,000 people, almost certainly more, internally and externally displaced 4 million people. And yet the very notion that our leaders should be punished under the principles of Nuremberg for that aggressive war is even a more marginalized notion than the fact that they should be punished for spying on American citizens. I mean, if you stand up in a media venue and say American leaders responsible for the Iraq war should be punished under Nuremberg, you will immediately be viewed as completely fringe and marginal, even though we said at Nuremberg that was going to be what would be guiding Western justice from this point with this point forward. And you see this all the time. I mean, the United States goes around lecturing other countries about the need to prosecute their own war criminals. President Obama gave an interview with Indonesian television, amazingly, last year, and he said, you know, he's been saying over and over to justify his protection of Bush officials, it's important that we look to the future and not the past. And yet what he told the Indonesians in this interview was exactly the opposite. He said, you must investigate these war crimes because you cannot move to the future until you've resolved the past. And this is the kind of double standards that we've seen applied for decades in the foreign relations context, and it's really that was the model, the template for creating this multi-tier justice system domestically as well.
Glenn, we've only got about a minute or so left, so I was just wondering, in the course of your travels now promoting the book and talking about it, I can imagine the response you're getting from people like my listeners and average citizens. Is this argument made its way into sort of the upper levels of mainstream discourse in the journalism community in Washington? I'm wondering what sort of response the people you're quite critical of in the book and politicians are giving it.
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, I've been able to talk about my book in lots of significant media venues. You know, the book has done well. It's been on the New York Times bestseller list. And so when the book starts to do well that way, it makes it much harder to ignore the arguments. But, you know, it's difficult to sort of have a book immediately change everything. But what you hope to do when you write a book like this is to bring the argument to as many places as possible that have yet to hear it. And the sort of more successful the book is, the more places you can make sure that argument is heard.
Well, Glenn Greenwald, I think I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio. I want to thank you so much for joining us today on Media Matters to talk about your new book, With Liberty and Justice for Some. Glenn Greenwald, again, thank you very much.
Good to talk to you.
And I want to thank Kyle Kroha, my engineer, for her great work. Melissa Trentz, my producer. Christina Williams, who's helping out now with Melissa as associate producer of sorts for now. And I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be back in 167 hours with another show. Everyone, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
The forecast for East Central Illinois. Today mostly cloudy with a high near 65. Tonight mostly cloudy with a low around 47. Tomorrow, a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms, mostly cloudy with a high near 63. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low around 44. Tuesday, mostly sunny with a high near 60. Tuesday night, mostly clear with a low around 32. And Wednesday, sunny.